There have been recent developments regarding Operation Kino.
Hello and welcome to Operation Kino, episode 135, the review segment for Friday, October 18th, 2013. Today we're reviewing 12 Years a Slave, which you have almost doubtlessly heard about at some point since the Toronto Film Festival or Telluride Film Festival, where it premiered and blew away virtually everybody who saw it. It is the third film from Steve McQueen, who made Hunger and Shame before this. Shame was, I believe, Patch's favorite film of 2011?
That is correct, much to David's dismay. I love that movie.
I think Dave was a fan of it as well. I knew a lot of people who were. I liked it fine.
I liked it. It's just, I think it's a fine movie, but compared to his other two, is an embarrassment. But you know, it's neither here nor there.
Well, 12 Years a Slave is much larger and I would say more ambitious than either of his previous two films. Michael Fassbender is in it, but in a small role. And it's based on a true story about a man named Solomon Northup who was living as a free man in Saratoga Springs, New York, and then was basically kidnapped and sold into slavery by these two asshole guys who did it for the cash. And this was a relatively common thing that happened in the pre-Civil War. I believe the film starts in like 1840, at some point about 20 years before the Civil War started. And it's based on his travelogue is a weird word for it. It's his novel about what happened to him. It's a
novel is also probably an inappropriate word for it.
I believe autobiography is the correct term here.
Well, I'm trying to express how episodic it is, how it's about what happened. So he went to this plantation, then he went to the next one. And there is a emotional narrative built into it. You know, in the second half of the film, he winds up on a plantation owned by Michael Fassbender's character, and you kind of get this conflict between the two of them. But for a while, it's kind of who he meets, who he's working for. There's kind of a parade of celebrity cameos for a while where it's Paul Giamatti, and then it's Benedict Cumberbatch, and then it's Paul Dano. But it settles down in the second half into this kind of battle of wills between him and Michael Fassbender. Chiwetel Ejiofor, who you've seen in a million things, and Salt, or Kinky Boots, or I think he's been in like a handful of other random blockbusters as some guy.
He was in Serenity.
Oh yeah, he was in Serenity. He's been working for a long time, but I don't think has ever really had a giant lead performance like this.
And he's only 35, apparently. I learned in a New York Magazine profile of him. Yeah,
also Keira Knightley's husband in Love Actually. Yeah. So that's important. Speaking of Richard Curtis, I feel like I could start jumping into giant superlatives about how much I like this movie and how hugely powerful I think it is. But I guess I'll let David do that since I've been talking time. And it's great to hear when David likes a movie.
Indeed, it is, especially for me. No, I mean, I think this is a phenomenal movie that you'll be hearing about for quite some time to come. I on that score, not much to add to it. I was really, I think Steve McQueen is an immense talent. I think this is an interesting chapter in his career because it, at least on the surface, it's the farthest removed of any of his features from his career as a visual artist, making installation, oriented film work before he made Hunger, which remains probably, in my mind, his best film and may be difficult to top, but 12 Years a Slave is close. It seems to, while there are certainly scenes that seem very sort of idiosyncratically McQueenish, particularly a scene in the middle of the movie with a protracted long take, which is very hard to scrub from your memory, and I think is really sort of one of the emotional peaks in the film, is otherwise the power of the direction is a lot less. Is a lot more subtle than it has been for him in the past. I think this is a story that has such a force unto itself that he doesn't really get out of the way. I think that would be an improper way to classify it, but he doesn't feel the need to shape it in maybe the same way that he did something like Hunger or Shame. There's a primal energy and emotion to a lot of these scenes that he allows to play out. And I think his penchant for long takes, not just that one in the middle of the movie, but several others throughout the film, really allows this terrific cast of actors that he has to do their best work. I think this is an extraordinary poacher. Not only, probably, and this isn't saying much, unfortunately, the best film ever made about American slavery, but is a really, for me, more than that, a brilliant portrait of compassion and a comprehensive one, not just the sort of power of, well, the power of compassion, both for good and evil, and sort of the various shadings therein. I think Benedict Cumberbatch's character in particular is really interesting and adds a lot to the movie in the same way that, or in the inverse of the way that his character detracts so much from August Osage County. They take a random pot shot at Benedict Cumberbatch.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, I think is they're very, like, the idea of compassion and how the smallest failings of compassion can build to a point where things are seen as natural, a natural law, is really sort of palpable in this film. And what struck me about it was that because it's so episodic and because there is such a blunt look at these events, McQueen doesn't really bend over backwards to bring you sort of the emotional edge throughout the movie. He sort of understands implicitly that the material will get you there. And so there aren't, while the score is overblown in a Hans Zimmer way, in a way that I thought actually was very uncharacteristic of Steve McQueen.
I like it a lot, but I see what you mean.
Yeah, I mean, especially on the riverboat and whoa. But anyway, the emotion is mostly sort of kept in check, and it's this sort of like building reservoir of empathy that you have for this character, and you really, you know, as you sort of go along his journey with him, and then as the film gets to its final moments, and all of it sort of the floodgates open, and it just unleashes all this emotion, a torrent, these years, these 12 years of pain and horror are finally begin to seep through and are able to be sort of expressed. And it is really, I think, as an audience member for me, who had sort of sat there coldly riveted for, you know, 130 minutes, the last few are just really, really, really moving. And yeah, I think it's a beautiful film that deserves all the praise it's getting. Chiwetel Ejiofor is wonderful. The supporting cast is great. Michael Fassbender and the newcomer whose name I will not even attempt because
Lupita,
I don't have it in front of me.
It's definitely Lupita, her last name.
Yeah. She's terrific. And, you know, I think that the parade of familiar faces is somewhat distracting. Paul Giamatti, his character, I mean, all of them are seen rather briefly. Paul Giamatti's character is very effective in the limited role that he has. Brad Pitt's character, on the other hand, Brad Pitt's company working parts, being one of the producing partners of this film, he shows up at a pivotal juncture in the film and does his Inglourious Bastards routine, and it is wildly out of place.
It's pretty bad.
And it's really, and it's at one of those, you know, important moments of the movie, and so that is,
I would probably go as far to say he is the only flaw.
Buongiorno.
I might feel that strongly about it, but yeah, he's pretty awful.
Yeah,
but
so
you know,
I
he
wonder,
put up the money to make it, so you know, right, he gets to
and
be the hero.
If we have to put up with his one scene to get the rest of the movie, I think that's a fair trade. But I wonder if Steve McQueen might want a mulligan on that. But Steve McQueen is, you know, by the furthest thing from a pushover you're ever going to find. So there must have been something in Brad Pitt's performance that he must have really thought was appropriate for.
Patches, I want to hear from you because I know that you like the movie, but you are a little bit more of a dissenter than I am, at least.
Yeah, well, it's interesting hearing David talk about it because I feel like I agree with most of the things that David says, except David ends with saying that it's a phenomenal, great film, and I'm kind of like, it's pretty good. I don't think this is that ambitious of a film that you mentioned, that this is a step up for McQueen from Hunger and Shame. I think there's a lot of ambition in trying to make those really intimate problems feel as grand as they are when we mull them over in everyday life. But to say that depicting slavery, the brutality, the awfulness of this stain on American history is not ambitious, that's not fair. It's not easy, but it's certainly, it feels like we're not digging into it as much in 12 Years a Slave. It's very much about how this energy hits us when we see it, when we see people whipping people, when we see people treating others in this way. It's
but I don't
it's
think
awful,
the film really
and it
makes this
wrenches my gut
of,
but
of that. You know, I mean, I think that like it's not really about, while it approaches slavery in totality, it does throw through the experience of one man, obviously. And I think that by virtue of doing that, it allows Steve McQueen not to focus on the spectacle and the images that you expect to see. Like when you watch a Holocaust film, you're like, okay, now I'm going to see the
right.
The camps and the people in the showers. I mean, I think it really just goes through his empirical experiences. And I think you actually, what is so moving about the film is that you really get this comprehensive portrait of slavery as a whole and the emotional factors, the psychological factors that contributed to it and made it possible.
Well, that's what I think I don't get enough of, and why it's ultimately not a mind-blowing experience for me, why this is not a great, great film, and it's merely very, very good. I think this is forceful empathy going on here. I mean, to feel this, it's about feeling the pain of this experience, and it's very successful in that, right? But what I don't get is what you're describing, David. I don't really feel the complexity of the psychology that goes into allowing these events to take place, and mostly because I feel very detached from the characters. It may have something to do with casting. It may be that these stars, it's like a parade of stars, and because of how episodic it is, it feels like a parade. It's like, and here's Paul Giamatti, and here's Michael K. Williams, and here's Michael Fassbender, and I never really get them. Like, I never really get to settle in with them and understand them and crack them. And even Chiwetel Ejiofor, who is, again, a phenomenal actor and someone who I could watch in anything for any amount of time, just to see him watch others in this film is probably the most powerful thing that McQueen does, just to sit on him and watch his reactions, his observations. But again, I don't really understand, like, there's a class issue going on here. He's not a slave. He's a free man who's brought into slavery, and he definitely regards himself as such. And I think it's an interesting idea that ultimately goes undermined.
Underused?
Yeah, underused, underexplored. I mean, it just could, he could dig into that more.
I think the whole point of that is it's something that's lingering in him throughout this entire experience.
I kind of assume that more than the movie gives me that.
The whole point of that is how arbitrary human law is and how these sort of arbitrary human distinctions are. He was a man of means, a free man, but otherwise no different fundamentally from any of the men who were, you know, were born.
I agree.
I mean, he was one and the same. And so I think by the speed at which the film rips his life away from him and drops him into this position, it's not just that it happens, but it does so in a flash that really sort of highlights how meaningless and arbitrary sort of class and racial and social distinctions are, and how man imposes these rules upon themselves to, you know, tragic ends.
I don't see it having a ripple effect that I believe it would, or to see, I don't go far enough into Solomon Northup's mind in this film, I guess is what I'm saying. It's very surface because it can be, because the surface details are so important and so emotional and so damaging, and they can be powerful. But I just wanted to go further into the situation, his situation. And when you mentioned Benedict Cumberbatch and that relationship, I found that very interesting. And again, it had to get to, like, timing and pacing in this movie is very strange. It's 12 years a slave, but, like, who knows how long he's spending at these different places. It doesn't feel very long at any given time. I'm not feeling the weight of the fact that he was enslaved for over a decade. It just it didn't have as much impact as I thought it would. And
while I agree that it's sort of unclear where in his journey you are, how many years into it, but I think that, like, it does contribute to this feeling. And I don't say this just to excuse McQueen. I mean, I genuinely felt intellectually, and this contributes to what I wanted to say to you to begin with, that it's about how lost he is in that time, how time sort of becomes irrelevant to him. It's like, you know, day in and day out, this is his existence. And then one day again, it changes at the same haste with which it started. But I think that the people that are having a problem with this film, if I'm able to make a sweeping generalization about it, are not either enjoying or not willing to engage with it. And the fact that it is, while on its surface it seems to be a very emotional film about people, I think it's ultimately just as interested in being a film about ideas. And I think for some people, they are thrown by that approach and how it manifests through its characters, or just not really.
I'm not sure how you're digging at me here, but I understand what it's trying to approach, and I'm not saying
it's a matter of you being stupid and not getting it. I'm just saying that when you are engaging in a film experience, you sort of and we experience this all the time, and that we go into a movie and we feel like it's going to be one thing, and then we're thrown by why it's another.
But I don't feel like my expectations weren't met in that way. I don't necessarily feel that. I feel like it's just teasing me.
I'm not talking about before you got to the theater. I'm talking about. Like during the movie, you feel because of the emotion inherent in the situation that it's, and this could speak to, you know, McQueen's failings or how it didn't work for you. I mean, I don't think it's anything about you. I'm just saying that it is surprising to me how much, and maybe less surprising because Steve McQueen directed it rather than somebody else, how while ostensibly such an emotional film, it really for me impacted me most as a film of ideas.
Right. Yeah, I mean, because it's based on a real person, because this is a movie driven by this one man and his observations, I really just wanted to crack him and understand more about how he was seeing all these different things. I mean, his relationship with Patsy, this woman that Michael Fassbender's slave owner becomes, he's enamored by her. He's in very much in a controlling position of her in all ways. And that's Lupita Nyong'o giving an amazing performance. I shouldn't underpraise this. I mean, I think everybody in this movie is spectacular. And she especially just like gives it her all and is fully immersed. And I'm seeing her. See, I like her character because she's drawn in many directions. You know, she flirts with the idea of pleasing her owner because of what that can do for her. But then she's broken the next second. Like, she can't get a grasp. She can't settle. She can't find a groove to live in. She can't beat the system. And I love how she's pulled back and forth in that way and how she's challenged by this impossible game that white people are playing with the slaves. And it's horrible. And it's always it's interesting to me that Solomon, throughout the film, even when he seems to settle, perhaps that might be the wrong word, but he's still driven to get home. He still has an eye on the prize, leaving, escaping, going home, being the free man that he is. Man, I would love more of that. How he's able to do that? How is he able to stay on track and always believe?
You definitely get part of the hero problem with him, and that he has one goal, and it's to escape, and he doesn't really waver in that goal. But I think what Ejiofor does,
understandably,
absolutely. But I think what he does is you get some of that like pretentiousness, like we were talking about, where he does know that he's more educated, and he is, you know, he's trying to connect with people on this level as an educated man, and how dangerous that can be for him. And also in the relationship he has with Michael Fassbender, I feel like that's where the movie really took this turn for me, where it was, you know, about more than kind of this story about, you know, really putting you in the place of what slavery was, but helping you understand the psychology that goes into these people. And you get this battle of the wills between him and Fassbender. I mean, there's this one very long scene. There's one shot of the two of them at night, and it's Solomon kind of trying to lie his way out of a situation and to outsmart this guy who's his slave owner, but he realizes is really not nearly as smart as he is. And I found that contrast so fascinating, and that in retrospect, it now reminds me of Captain Phillips, where you have these scenes where you're watching Tom Hanks think and you're watching him think his way out of these situations. And I got so much of that from Chiwetel Ejiofor, that the fact that Solomon is the hero who has one singular goal that doesn't waver, really, that did not feel dull to me.
Yeah, maybe the beats are there for me and timing ends up being the problem. Even though I totally understand what you're saying, David, we should feel lost in this mess of time, because when you are enslaved, you know, time probably has no meaning and you could become lost in that way. But to not be able to track it, I just don't feel the weight of every passing year. I feel like I need to feel that more. I felt like I was in the exact moment of that every beat, as opposed to feeling the weight kind of snowballing as this movie went on, which is interesting, but ultimately left me a little cold. Also, what you mentioned about the Hans Zimmer score, fuck that guy. I'm so tired of the music, this same conventional bullshit every single time. The music in this film is awful. Like, let me live in this movie. Get away from this manufactured crap.
The diegetic music, the music that you actually see in the film, is tremendous.
And it has such power. And
yeah.
It could have lived and breathed on its own like that. And yeah, the stuff, Paul Dano has a song in this before getting his typical beating, which happens in every movie now. You know, oddly enough, that kind of stuff takes me out of the movie too. Like, why is Paul Dano playing the exact same character? I see too many movies, I suppose.
I feel like
that's something I have to live with. I understand. I admit that. But yeah, this movie has a little too much Sheen. Hollywood Sheen. Maybe that's Brad Pitt.
Not Charlie Sheen.
That's so, like, the way that it looks and the score that it uses, I feel like is so discounting the way that the narrative works and the way that he's playing
Why is it discounting?
I think accusing him of having too much Hollywood Sheen really, at least, glides over a huge amount of things it's doing that have nothing to do with the way Hollywood would tell this story. And the fact that Hollywood hasn't told this story, that there have been...
I mean, I'm not going to give a movie points because it's doing a little better job.
I think it's doing a vastly better job, but obviously that's...
Okay, but still, it can be doing an exceptional job in many arenas and still have faults in others. I mean,
but the fact that it's beautifully photographed does not mean that it's too...
I don't have a problem with the photography. I mean... McQueen, once again, I mean, there's so many visuals that I want to revisit, even though dread fills every moment and my gut was all wrenched the entire time. I mean, like David was mentioning, there's some long shots in this film, and that might actually be computer assisted at some point, but it doesn't even matter. I mean, it's so fluid. This one scene involving some lashing and going drifting to each character and just being in that moment, that was such an exciting piece of filmmaking. It's stunning to look at, but no, that's not what I mean by Hollywood Sheen. I'm mostly talking about conventional score and filling it with way too many well-known actors.
I like.
Yeah, it didn't really. I mean, you know, I think it didn't. I had noticed it, but I didn't think it was overwhelming. It's not.
Hey, I'm allowed to not be in love with every movie. Hey, come on, and don't look down on me.
Yeah,
score man. Patches, I assume that you would still recommend 12 Years a Slave.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm just trying to
Temper. Assume that you hate black people.
Oh, yeah, that too.
He thinks that slavery has been discussed too much. We're over it.
Can't we just move on?
I know.
I'm over it. Katie, I don't feel like you've defended this enough as we wrap up here.
Well, you guys kept fighting with each other. I couldn't get a word in edgewise.
Tell us.
I mean, I feel like I'm saying most of the same things that David said. I think basically it's the strength of these performances and the way that this movie, and David has pointed this out even before I saw it, that the way it's specific in its story, and you're seeing this one account of an experience, and then, you know, not an uncommon account, but not the usual slave narrative that we hear where you're, you know, born into it or taken from Africa, like this guy who had experiences of both sides of the world. And it just, it put me into this world, and it made me see what the systems that were in place to make this happen, and the way that you have slave owners who are not evil specifically, but who are interesting and have their own,
consider themselves evil,
or you know, who are not just
have an overdue, you know, and it shows, I think, very crucially the spectrum of morality, and I think how you know, events like these events, I mean, giant cataclysmic social divides like these happen. Not because people are born as good or evil, and you know, this isn't the first movie to address this, but because you know, oftentimes people are able to contextualize the actions they make and the choices they make in a way that, you know, could certainly be seen as maybe not evil, but very immoral. But you know, they put themselves in the position of the time and think that they're doing a reasonable, human, decent thing, when in fact the opposite was true.
What I think blew me away by this movie in the end is I can see a movie's about heartbreaking things and kind of feel moved by them, but not feel drawn into them. And I felt so much empathy for Solomon and the people in the situation. I just felt this outrage and this kind of sorrow throughout the entire thing that was really intense. And I think part of that isn't the storytelling, part of it's the performance. And it's just the way that this movie is really committed to putting you inside this story that would have been really easy to tell in a much more sweeping and much more generalizing way, that I was so grateful to have had the chance to be in this terrible world that created the world that we're actually in now.
Not enough Quvajine.
Nope. She actually has, I think, literally zero lines.
What?
Yeah, she plays his daughter.
What?
And Dwight Henry from Beasts of Southern Wild makes an appearance in this film as a guy being zipped up into a body bag.
I mean, I haven't seen the film in a while, but I certainly don't remember watching it and thinking, oh, there's Quvenzhané Wallace.
She's Solomon Northup's daughter. He tucks her in the head at the very beginning of the film.
She's his daughter? Oh, now, you know what? I'm with Patches.
Good thing.
The Southern Wild was so bad that maybe, I think that, like,
we're not having this conversation.
But, I think that, you know what? Maybe to flip this around, she has atoned in some small way.
So now you're excited for Annie, the remake.
for the horrors of Beasts of the Southern Wild by at least appearing in this movie. But she didn't really contribute to this movie. It could have been anybody's kid. So,
in conclusion, 12 Years a Slave is a very good movie. You may have your kibbles with it, but you should definitely see it. And this will be far from the last time you hear people talking about it over the next few months. So go see it.
Did my Lord deliver Daniel, deliver Daniel, deliver Daniel? Did my Lord deliver Daniel, and why not every man? He delivered Daniel from the lion's den, Jonah from the belly of a whale, and the Hebrew children from the fiery furnace, and why not every man? Did my Lord deliver Daniel, deliver Daniel, deliver Daniel? Did my Lord deliver Daniel, and why not every man? The moon runs down in a purple stream, the sun refused to shine. Every star did disappear, yes, freedom shall be mine. Did my Lord deliver Daniel, deliver Daniel, deliver Daniel? Did my Lord deliver Daniel, and why not every man?
Also coming out this Friday, in addition to Escape Plan and The Fifth Estate and various other movies we won't be talking about, is Kill Your Darlings, which you may have heard stars Daniel Radcliffe as Allen Ginsberg, which is exactly as attention-getting as you would imagine from that description. I saw this movie way back at Sundance, so it's been a while, but I was a fan of it at the time, and I just kind of wanted to give it a little bit of attention now that it's finally coming out. It's directed by John Krakaitis. It's his first film, although he spent a very long time trying to get it made. And it follows Allen Ginsberg when he enrolled at Columbia and befriends this guy named Lucien Carr, who's played by Dane DeHaan, who is in everything these days.
Lucien Carr, was he a Hufflepuff?
He was a he's a oh, Harry Potter jokes. So Allen Ginsberg befriends this guy, Lucien Carr. Allen Ginsberg, obviously famously gay, develops a crush on this guy, but then it gets way more complicated when Lucien Carr murders a man who the film says he was in a relationship with. I think the historical fact is a little bit fuzzier. I mean, this movie has a lot of crazy directorial flourishes that are kind of on and off. Like, there's a bunch of scenes of them doing drugs that are a little heavy duty, but I really like, I thought Daniel Radcliffe was great as Allen Ginsberg. I thought Dane DeHaan was phenomenal as a Lucien Carr. I mean, he's been kind of playing teenage Leonardo DiCaprio for a couple of years, and then he just turns in this really like sexually charged performance as this charming guy that I was really blown away by. And I don't know, I like the movie in general. It's not the greatest thing I've seen this year, but I enjoy it. And I think it's, if you're interested in the beats or interested in seeing if Daniel Radcliffe can actually act, which I was skeptical about, I think it's worth a look.
I'm mostly with you on that. I liked how it moved. I mean, I liked that it felt like reading beat poetry or something. It certainly has an energy to it that was necessary, and it accomplished that. So I know that David, I'm going to point at David and make him come out with his feelings, his true feelings
come
about
out.
What can I say?
Kill
it's really hard
kill that
to,
darling.
It's really hard. I think the same challenge that faced On the Road and a number of similar movies is that it's really hard to film a revolutionary idea, which is more or less what this movie is trying to do in the macro perspective. And you see a lot of various tactics used to try to make that palpable, that sort of feeling they're on the cusp of this sort of new paradigm of thought. And once again, it didn't really work for me. And I think the movie really becomes a mess in the third act. I don't think that it really compellingly cements the relationship between, I mean, I'm interested in the relationship between Ginsburg and Carr, but I don't think that the Ginsburg, Carr's murder of David Kammerer, who's played rather wincingly by Michael C. Hall. I didn't think that it was the lines really drawn in a way that I found compelling between Ginsburg's friendship with Carr and what the fallout of that was. And I think the way the entire third act the film is handled is sort of messy. There are moments in the movie that work rather well. I think that there is a scene which was created from fiction and was not a real life incident, in which they break into the Library of Columbia and replace all the texts with.
That is not true.
Cancer. No, it is not true. Oh. But it is a scene that works really effectively and really cuts to the heart of how they felt. It uses anachronistic music. Uses "Wolf at the Door" by TV on the Radio. "Wolf Like Me" by TV on the Radio. "Wolf at the Door" is a Radiohead song. Really well, but I just never. And the acting was fun. I just never really cared about anything that was happening in this movie. I didn't understand what it was saying to me about the Beat Generation that I didn't already know. Any sort of compelling parallels to our day and age, if they were there, were not felt by me. I just don't think this is a movie.
Not a movie about ideas, you know?
Shut up. It's, it didn't really do much for me.
I want to, we can stop talking about this, but I do think that Jack Huston, who's known as Richard Harrow on Boardwalk Empire, makes a really good Jack Kerouac.
I think he makes a really bland Jack Kerouac. And I was like, where is Sam... What's his
Riley?
Sam Riley. Sam Riley was fantastic in On the Road. But
and when you're doing things in your movie that are making me compare On the Road favorably to this film, then
and one last shout out to Ben Foster as William S. Burroughs, who I also thought was really good. And I'm
but
I do something different than like little kid weirdo.
Yeah, he plays an older
weirdo,
drug-addled weirdo.
very different.
Even though the film didn't knock my socks off, I do admire. John Cocytus for seeing it through and for the the passion. And I think the passion that he had for this project is palpable on screen, at least in fits and starts. And I hope that it does not take him 9 years or whatever to get the next one made.
I want to pitch a movie where Ben Foster plays an aggressive, brooding weirdo who keeps beating up Paul Dano. To have like the ultimate type cast roles buddy comedy thing.
I feel like that's a segment three or a mini segment at some point. Like, which type cast can we put in one movie?
Yes. Oh my god, it's perfect.
Blow the world away.
I wanted to mention one other movie that's coming out that no one really is talking about, but I saw at the Hamptons Film Festival last year. Katie, you probably did not actually see this, but it's called Adventures in the Sin Bin, and is a very very funny teen sex comedy. Which those are rare these days, starring, Jillian Jacobs, Ben McKenzie, Jeff Garlin, Tim Blake Nelson, also Bo Burnham is probably the biggest name in the leads, and this guy Michael Cedar is the real lead, obviously filling out the ensemble cast with some names and letting these no-name people to do most of the heavy lifting. It's very, very funny. It's kind of a riff on The Apartment. Except the Sin Bin is a van that this Michael Cedar character is kind of lending out so that his high school pals can bang chicks. Nice. And I was highly entertained, and it's not getting very much love. And I saw a poster that came out for it, and it's probably one of the most horrible Photoshop jobs in the last decade. It's just not fair. So definitely check that out.
All right. On that note, Patches. What was our lightning round question this week?
Yes, it was in honor of the new Carrie, which they have not shown us yet, which is probably a good sign because they're saving the good stuff for later.
I want us to be really excited.
What is your favorite remake of a previous film? So actually, somebody said 21 Jump Street, and that is not a previous film, so...
So you lose.
That person lost.
Please stop listening to us.
Although 21 Jump Street is still very funny movie. Very funny movie.
David, what's your pick?
Oh, geez. Let's see here. Well, someone also picked The Thing.
Many people said The Thing and
echoed
you.
But I'll go with Brian Gallagher, Gallagher MW, who said Scarface, just because I'm not really a big fan of the De Palma Scarface, but I am a big fan of the original film by Howard Hawks, and I would just take any opportunity to call attention to it. So check it out.
Patches?
I'm trying to think. You know, I had a tough time picking a remake at all that I liked. Jesse Karp said The Fly. That's very good. But I may actually go with At Hedgerows, our friend Zoe, who said The Mummy, which kind of blows me away that someone would say The Mummy, which is a very fun film. As she puts it, she still loves it. Spirit of the original pulled into the madness of our modern age. And I don't know if that's an apt description, but it's a lot of fun to watch on TNT when I'm like hungover on Sundays. So there you go.
For the record, I also said The Fly. So
Oh, right. Well, I don't really pay attention to you.
We're on that podcast, as it turns out.
Barely.
I am going with Duncan House, who says The Beat That My Heart Skipped. And I haven't actually seen the original film that was based on, but I think remakes in other languages, especially when it's an American film being remade in another country, can be really interesting just for what other cultures can bring to it. So I would rather have that. Although, of course, whenever we remake like French comedies or something, it turns out terrible. The original film is Fingers.
Right.
Toback.
Yeah. And which I haven't seen it, but I like that movie. I remember seeing it at like Lincoln Square when I was an intern.
Beat That My Heart Skipped is awesome.
Yeah.
And
it's been a long time since I saw it.
I have no idea. I have never seen Fingers and I'm never going to. So
well, there you go.
Such thoughtful remake commentary we have going on here. I think that does it for today's episode. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I am Matt Patches. I write about movies all over the internet, and I compile it all on mattpatches.com, my Tumblr, and I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior editor of film.com. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich and at film.com. And that's it.
I'm Katie Rich. You can find me here at Cinema Blend or on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.
Ka-chow.
Ka-chow.